Today in Studio 360, I go shopping with an artist who finds his inspiration in the biggest of America's big box stores.
Beauty sometimes just captures us in very inexplicable ways. Yeah.
Painting pictures at Walmart. By the way, 19-inch TV for $98. I'm tempted to buy one just because it's $98. And we'll get positively un-American with a private performance from the former First Lady of France, pop chanteuse Carla Bruni.
I don't think it's the same to sing, you know, in Italian, in French, or in German, or in English. French people are Italian people in a bad mood.
She said it, not me. I'm Kurt Anderson. That and more is ahead today in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Right after this.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion, presenting the new 2014 Scion TC. With modified steering and suspension to improve driving precision and a new look, the Scion TC is designed to go the distance. Learn more at scion.com.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. We talk all the time on this show about how art and life influence each other in a constant feedback loop. Just last week, there was a jewel heist in Cannes, the movie festival city on the French Riviera.
My jewels!
One man in hat and scarf walked into a jewelry exhibit at the fancy Cannes Hotel, the hotel where Hitchcock shot scenes of Cary Grant as an ex-jewel robber in To Catch a Thief.
But you claim to be innocent.
I do more than claim, I insist.
He pulled a pistol, hurt nobody, and left a few minutes later with $136 million worth of diamonds. And speaking of life imitating caper movies, there is also a gang of globe-trotting jewel thieves called the Pink Panthers. Luxury locales, a team of colorful, clever lowlifes executing pretty perfect crimes, bags of diamonds, multinational detectives on their tail.
I don't know why people spend money on diamonds. You know, I don't suffer from this showing off. I have a Rolex, but as a souvenir. But diamonds? Nah, they don't attract me. You know, for me, diamonds mean good cash. Nothing else.
Those are the words of a member of the Pink Panthers, and now they are the subject of a movie, a new documentary called Smash and Grab. It's directed by British filmmaker Havana Marking, who joins me now. Havana, welcome to Studio 360.
Hi there.
And by the way, your name is kind of like something in a movie as well, isn't it?
Yeah, I was conceived in Cuba.
Really?
Yeah.
So the Pink Panthers, by and large, are still at large, right?
Well, actually, that's interesting. The police, the international police forces, are actually doing an incredible job. And in the last 6 months, there's been a huge number of arrests. So the net is really closing in on them.
Is there any coincidence that they agreed to cooperate with you for this film and then got caught?
No, there isn't. Thankfully, for my own safety. No, all these extraordinary events that have been happening recently are, you know, I was just lucky to sort of witness the wave.
And the this amazing $136 million robbery in Cannes was or might have been committed by members of this gang?
I mean, for the time being, there's no knowing exactly. And there are other people who steal diamonds, but not many. And
really, this is kind of a cartel.
The thing is that really anyone in a way can steal a diamond, but what do you do with the diamond when you've got it? What the Pink Panthers have, which very few people have, is the networks and the contacts that allow them to recut the diamonds, create new certificates for their authentication, and then get them back in the market. So that's the real brilliance of that.
Which is why, frankly, rather than the normal stupid criminals who don't know what they're doing, it reminds one of George Clooney or Steve McQueen doing it.
Yeah, I mean, it's a dangerous comparison, but yes, obviously. And they have to be confident, you know, they need to speak languages, to the local languages, to be able to fit in and not be noticed. So there's definitely an element of sophistication. It's not just thug work.
And to make it again more kind of unbelievably spectacular, just last week, some of them broke, armed men broke into a Swiss prison and and busted out some of the Panthers.
Yeah, I mean, it was classic Panther in the sense that it was incredibly well organized, it was incredibly efficient, and ultimately no one was hurt in it.
That is part of their signature, and again, part of their charm, is that they have tended not to use violence.
Yeah, absolutely. I think mainly because you're going to get away with it a lot longer if you don't draw the kind of attention that violence brings. So, you know, if murder is very different from stealing a diamond.
And the documentary features interviews with some of the people at Interpol and elsewhere who have been following these guys. I want to play a clip of one of them talking to you.
Sometimes working on bad guys, there is something very particular, very special between, there is a respect, but at the same time, it's like a game. They know that we are hunting them, because it's a little bit like that. From Pacino and De Niro in the film, it was like that, but there are always movies. They are not the reality.
This cop, perhaps like the Panthers, sees himself as a character in a film, really.
I know. So it didn't surprise me at all that the criminals kind of go, oh, yeah, it was like a movie. This happened. It was just like a movie. But it really surprised me that the policemen talked like that as well. And on the walls of their offices were posters of Michael Mann films. You know, there was Miami Vice.
Speaking of Pacino and De Niro. Yes.
Exactly. So they definitely did have kind of respect for the Panthers and their methods.
Well, and again, making it, as you tell the story, even more like a Hollywood script, there's the beautiful woman who gets into this for love.
Yeah, and I was very proud of the fact, actually, that I did manage to interview a woman member of the gang. When I first started doing my research, a lot of the journalists were like, oh, women, they're just the eye candy. They're not really part of the gang. Actually, they're very key to the roles. They have to do a lot of the scouting and, you know, they go into jewelry shops and absolutely with sort of photographic memory, remember where the cameras are, where the exits are, where the doors are, what the potential dangers.
So that's the Julia Roberts role, really.
Exactly.
So you decide you're interested in this gang. You meet people who know people who know people and get to them. How, though, did you convince them to cooperate with you?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, Mike and Layla, my two main characters, they can't talk about it to people. They can't even talk about it to their loved ones. They can't talk about it to their children. They can't say, this is what I do every day. And it's a human need to discuss your life. And so actually I realized that it was incredibly cathartic for them.
So that's like the Sopranos then, in that case.
It is, surprisingly. I was the shrink. It did feel like that. There were moments when it felt like that. It was interesting, especially with Layla, the woman. So you have that kind of, obviously, the action and the kind of traditional Hollywood glamour of that sort of Ocean's 11 type thing. Actually, what you get to in the film and what I really sort of understood in these interviews, they're not happy people.
Right.
They're paranoid. They're depressed. Their relationships are broken down.
Yes, you show all the darkness as well as the fun.
Yeah. I mean, it's not a glamorous life. Yeah. You know, they're not retiring in the sun. So I think that's an important thing. But also a thing that, yeah, maybe Hollywood might be interested in that because it's a new take.
Havana Marking, thank you so much.
Thank you.
When he was fresh out of college in the 1990s, Brendan O'Connell did what a lot of arty American kids used to do, went to live in Europe. When he came back, he followed in the footsteps of his very American idols, Edward Hopper and Marsden Hartley. He took everyday American life as his subject matter. But there's nothing nostalgic about Brendan O'Connell's paintings, because everyday life for him meant real everyday American life. He went to Walmart. For the last 6 years, O'Connell has captured the people and the merchandise in the ultimate American mega retailer in colorful, impressionistic paintings. You can see some of them at studio360.org. I recently met up with O'Connell at an enormous Walmart in North Bergen, New Jersey. So where are we? Which number Walmart is this? Oh,
okay. This is the North Bergen, and it's sort of the flagship store.
Really?
What they call a flagship store.
Well, should we go into store number, whatever this is?
Number many.
Hi, how are you? Welcome to Walmart.
When you think about the whole vastness of this environment, there must be 35 cashiers here.
Right.
Which sets up an astonishing visual pattern.
And I mean, is that what first appealed to you about these places? Is the, well, you tell me, the vastness?
Well, because I had never been in one this big until I came to this one.
Uh-huh.
The original idea was I was doing art about everyday life. And so I would have people getting dressed or brushing their teeth or just doing very ordinary things. And someone suggested I follow someone out into the world. And so I did my first Walmart shoot where I had this actress bought her groceries and she shopped. So I took these photographs.
And when you say an actress, that was your process. You would take a model out and shoot them in life and then paint based on that.
And so the irony was, I mean, I was a stock boy in a grocery store in college. So I kind of
Winn-Dixie, I've read.
Winn-Dixie, yes. And so in that, just the visual environment of, I find it kind of disorienting and mesmerizing all at once. I hated stocking shelves, but the act of doing it and seeing the patterns, there's something kind of, I guess, mesmerizing and disorienting are the two words that effectively cover the experience. Our attempt to find and construct beauty and order out of things, I think we always have that impulse. So even this huge curated space that is disorienting, our eye wants to simplify and focus, and even if it's unconscious, we want to experience beauty.
Yeah. Your paintings in Walmart are stylistically they're not hard edged, they're kind of loose and impressionistic. They are humanized and friendly. Whereas when somebody says, oh, this serious artist is painting Walmarts, one brings a certain set of expectations that, oh, it's going to be some
Andy Warhol.
Warhol 50 years later, hard-edged, kind of vaguely contemptuous, ironic thing. And that's not what you're doing.
Well, Warhol was a genius who opened everything up for what followed since 1960. But his images were cold and remote to me. I do like the softer, handmade slash just warmer quality of it. But let's not underestimate our sort of fetishistic relationship with brands.
Yeah.
What I'm stunned is people call me up and say, would you paint Swedish Fish? Will you paint Cheetos? It brings back a memory and intimacy with something from their past. And nostalgia is a significant part of this.
Uh-huh. And here we are at a Savor the Flavor giant Cheetos dump.
Yeah. And so my professor from Emory, she was like, if you paint 6 feet of Cheetos, I'm going to make political interpretations of that.
Right.
But someone from another part of the country with different political views would see
say, cool, a bunch of Cheetos.
Isn't God in America great that we can have 6 feet of Cheetos?
Yeah.
If you leave it in the ambiguous zone where people take away what they want to take away from the image, it's much more interesting than, you know, having an agenda or an axe to grind.
By the way, a 19-inch TV for $98. I'm tempted to buy one just because it's $98. So the better part of a decade, you've been doing this. At what point did Walmart learn of you and decide, no, you're fine, we like this, keep coming back, and we'll arrange for you to come back and give you stuff?
Well, 2010, I did a show in Boston, and the Globe gave me a full page on a Sunday. And then I did NPR and said I'd been invited to leave a lot of Walmarts. And then they said, we'd like to make it easy on you. So this was the first store I came to and had an official shoot.
This store. Huh. Given that, not that you were like making a dark critique of Walmart before, but there was something subversive because you could get kicked out.
Right.
And you got kicked out. Now you're...
Just to mix it up, sometimes I still do the surreptitious thing, even though I have full access, probably for the same reason that you're talking about, the anonymous element.
Right. And you don't want to be a total lapdog.
Yes.
Patronized character.
And here, I mean, and what's so amazing about Walmart has always been to me is you go directly from, you know, the cereal aisle a few paces later, essentially, here's a couch, you know, I mean, and an iPad. How much of your time in the last X years, six, 8 years, has been spent on this project?
Probably half. I used to be a closet figurative painter, and all the shows I did were abstract paintings.
Uh-huh.
Now it's the opposite. At the same time, the Walmart series allows me to stuff a bunch of different kinds of paintings into a different brand. I can play with all forms of 20th century painting under this idea.
How do you play with abstract painting in the Walmart frame?
Some of the paintings are really, really abstract. And then other paintings are really photo-based. And so I have that wide range. And then, you know, from very actionist, fat brush, slop it on, to very anal detail.
How many have you been in, do you think, Walmart?
Walmart's? 3 dozen? 4 dozen?
Why do you need to go to so many? Is it finding the subtle differences that's interesting at a certain point, or is it just that's the project, I'll go to a lot of different Walmarts?
It's several fold. You go to Santa Fe Walmarts, the demographics of the people are entirely right. different.
And since you paint the people, that matters.
That matters. And
how many pictures have you made based on those images?
The small ones, definitely hundreds, because some of the small ones are like 12 by 12. As far as large ones, you know, a couple dozen.
Yeah. So you've been doing this for going on a decade. I mean, when will this be played out for you creatively? Like, okay, I'm done with Walmart.
I guess over the next 6 months to 12 months, I am going to go to a half a dozen remote places around America. I'm going to be painting in Houston for a day. I'm going to go to the Amish Walmart in Ohio.
There's an Amish Walmart?
It's fitted for
Amish. I want to go there.
You can come. And then I had the idea of, because my wife's a landscape painter and she does everything not man-made and very bucolic, that we get an RV.
This is plein air of a kind, right?
We get an RV and she paint the Tetons and I paint Idaho Falls Walmart, or she paint Yosemite.
That's your plan?
That was one idea.
You know what I'm thinking? Reality show.
and so I'd like to visit a half a dozen and do that as a combination documentary book. So I mean, there's the, how does the series continue to maintain life? It has to evolve and continue evolving.
Brennan, it has been a pleasure. Thanks for bringing me to Walmart and letting me inside your project.
Thank you so much.
You can see a slideshow of Brendan O'Connell's Walmart paintings at studio360.org. Coming up, a vacant lot in downtown Detroit is transformed into a slice of suburbia when an artist builds a full-size replica of his childhood home. But there's something maybe a little too Stephen King about the basement.
It makes you feel like you're lost, even though you're maybe 20 feet into it or 30. You just don't feel entirely safe in there.
We'll look at an artist's very private story told in a work of public art. Mike Kelly's Mobile Homestead is later this hour in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion, presenting the new 2014 Scion TC. With modified steering and suspension to improve driving precision and a new look, the Scion TC is designed to go the distance. Learn more at scion.com.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson.
I used to have Rock Band back in high school.
Battle of the High School Bands.
Excellent!
We have been talking all summer about our Battle of the High School Bands contest. We got more than 300 entries, including this wonderful slice of 1979 punk pop called Debutantes in Bondage.
As I was making my social debut.
It's by The Welders, who were an all-girl band in St. Louis, and back in the late 70s, loved punk rock and comedy.
My name's Kelly Draper, but I went by Rusty Welder when I played with The Welders, sort of taking after the Ramones at that point. The Welders were composed of me, Jane Fujimoto, who was Jane Welder, Caroline Fujimoto, who was Caroline Welder, of course, and then Colleen Cowan, who was Colleen Welder. Three of the girls actually went to McClure North High School in St. Louis, and I went to Oakville Senior High in St. Louis. We formed in about 1975, and at that time we were about 13 years old, and we just knew we loved music and the Marx Brothers, and we finally started gathering instruments, and by 1976 we're starting to play songs together. And then gradually we got into punk music, which was sort of fortuitous as far as our playing abilities at the time. Most of the time we were trying to write songs that had some humor to them, but also I think at the time it was kind of a reaction to the 70s where walking down the street, you know, guys felt pretty free about commenting on appearance and making lewd comments, so this was sort of a reaction to some of that too. We had a reunion in 2009. There's a local label in town, BDR Records, that was kind of scouring the archives of local punk bands and reissuing recordings from that time. We were really surprised by how well received the single was, because at the time we recorded those songs, we didn't feel we were being appreciated, I guess you could say. So it was pretty gratifying.
That's Kelly Draper. She played in The Welders back in 1979 and submitted one of their songs to our Battle of the High School Bands Challenge. We'll announce the winner later this month.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America.
And it wouldn't be high school if we didn't make you a mixtape. We've put together volume one of a killer compilation of our favorite submissions. Check it out at studio360.org.
Run and knock you out of bed. Run to the shower and you know your soul feels dead. Eat your breakfast, leave in a rush. Run to the corner, don't miss your bus. We're having fun in high school. It's time to go to high school.
Last week, we talked about how Detroit's bankruptcy, the largest municipal bankruptcy in history, could lead to a sell-off of $100 million masterpieces from the world-class museum, the Detroit Institute of Arts. This week, we return to Detroit to another museum a few doors down from the DIA, along Woodward Avenue. In the parking lot of the Museum of Contemporary Art, Detroit, behind a chain-link fence, is a little house.
It's great when you're driving down Woodward Avenue and you suddenly come across this suburban ranch home in the middle of downtown Detroit. I think it's a sort of like, causes you to look twice, you know.
It's strange how it stands out in the city of Detroit because there's really absolutely nothing like it.
It's painted white with blue shutters, nicely mowed lawn. It almost looks like a movie set. The house is called Mobile Homestead. And it's the last piece of art by the artist Mike Kelly, who was born near Detroit, spent his career in Los Angeles, and died last year. It's a work of public art that contains very private secrets. Julia Lowry Henderson has our story.
The house Mike Kelly grew up in is in the suburb of Westland, about 24 miles from Detroit. It's owned by a retired barber named John DeBosey. After Kelly became a successful artist in California, flying all over the world working on projects, he went back to the house, along with his old friend, Carrie Lauren.
There were a couple times, actually, maybe two or three times that we went to the house. And Mike always seemed to, you know, he'd ring the doorbell and he'd have a checkbook in his hand and, you know, he was ready to write him a check, but he obviously didn't want to sell.
So Mike Kelly did the next best thing. He recreated the house on a lot next to MOCAD, the Museum of Contemporary Art, Detroit. The layout is just like Kelly's childhood home, but it feels like a school building or a clinic. It's intended as a public space, although he wasn't too clear what would take place here. Right now, the living room is a lending library.
I mean, in terms of the floor, I mean, it's vinyl composite tile, VCT, as we say in the industry.
MOCAD's John Brummett showed me around.
You can tell there's a puppet show going on in the background, so this is one of the, you know, one of the many treats I think we have in store for us as we continue.
There's also an electronic keyboard that plays constantly. But that's the ground level. If you go into one of the closets, there's a hatch. Open up the hatch, there's a ladder. This is not public space. Mary Claire Stevens, the director of the Mike Kelly Foundation, took me down, carefully.
Mike designed this subterranean area as a space where artists would work. It would not be accessible to the public, and it would just be a place for underground activities. He describes it as rituals and rites of an aesthetic nature.
The basement has the same floor plan as the ground floor, but there are no doorways to move between rooms. This is not some cozy rec room. They're like bunkers. To get from room to room, you have to climb down another ladder through another hole in the floor and make your way through a tunnel in the sub-sub level and then climb up another ladder into the next room.
It's not a very comfortable space. It's very strange, and it makes you feel like you're lost, even though, you know, you're maybe 20 feet into it or 30. You kind of lose your, you know, equilibrium or something. You don't feel entirely safe in there.
Right now, Carrie Lauren and artist Jim Shaw, another old friend of Mike's, are the only people allowed down here. It's hard to know what to make of the subterranean levels. They're creepy. Also kind of ridiculous. John Welchman, Kelly's longtime friend and an art professor at UC San Diego, read me something Kelly once wrote about tunnels.
Down, down, down you go into a secret buried chamber. And once you've gotten past your trauma, your conditioning, once you've gotten past your thinking that your life is surrounded by dirt, then things start to open up. In this blackness, can you tell the difference between the shifting claustrophobia of the living grave and the limitless expanses of outer space? I think not. So just relax. It's a funny quote, that.
It's funny, but Mike was increasingly agoraphobic. Was he hiding something down there? Or was he hiding from something down there?
He was obsessed with this idea of subterranean space.
And with trauma and secrets. Mary Claire Stevens says it started early in his career.
He's really well known from his work in the 80s, which included these work with found stuffed animals, and it's a series called Half a Man.
Mike sewed together stuffed animals and knit dolls that he found in flea markets. They looked pretty grungy. One of those dolls showed up on the cover of a Sonic Youth album.
It got a lot of press, and everyone thought, what's up with this artist? You know, he must have been abused as a child. He's making work all about molestation and child abuse.
Here's Mike Kelly from a 2010 interview.
The works I was making with stuffed animals or craft materials were being interpreted through some kind of politic of child abuse, which was not my intention. So I thought this has become basically a kind of American religion of victimization. And that's when I felt I started to have to address my own biography through these terms and deal with this problem through fictions of my own biography.
When Mike Kelly says religion of victimization, he's talking about the stories of recovered memories and child abuse that became very high profile in the 80s and 90s, like the McMartin preschool trial, where caregivers were accused of satanic ritual abuse of children. Kelly fixated on this story, and it influenced a lot of his work. In one project called Educational Complex, he built models of all the schools he attended. He made the models just from memory, and the spaces he couldn't remember, he left blank, and then filled in the blanks with videos of forgotten traumas that might have happened there. Kelly said he had never been victimized, but he kept playing with this idea that he had.
After a while of working with this kind of fantasy space, I thought it would be interesting to start to work with an actual space.
That actual space is Mobile Homestead. In 2006, he secured a lot behind the Museum of Contemporary Art Detroit. He made the facade first and made videos of it driving around the city on a flatbed. Scott Benzel was his video producer.
What ultimately happened was the video became, as things with Mike often do, it became a whole, not just a single feature, but three sort of feature-length pieces. One headed west on Michigan Avenue, one headed east, and then one of the events that took place during the launching of the mobile portion of it.
Finally, late in January 2012, he hammered out all the details for the construction of the house, his Detroit homecoming.
Mike signed off on the video on Friday. He signed the contract for the completion of the artwork of the house itself on Saturday, and then took his life probably on Monday.
Kelly had struggled with depression his whole life. But in that last year when he was working on Mobile Homestead, everything seemed to escalate.
A couple of us who had generally been in contact with him almost every day couldn't find him. Our phone calls weren't returned, and we called each other. And three of us went over to his house, and to cut a long story short, we found his body there.
Mike left no note. He offered no explanation. What he left was Mobile Homestead.
You know, I think people that are living try to make sense of it. And, you know, I don't know if we have to, but he was really kind of tired, you know. He was really fed up, I think, with the whole, you know, system of the art world. And, you know, he had so much pressure and just, you know, he hated it. He had everything kind of in place. This was his last statement, and I think it's leaving with, I think, a very positive note.
When I first went through the tunnels, the thought that came to my mind was like, oh, you know, Mike would have loved this. He would have, you know, he would have been laughing. Yeah, he would have just been laughing nonstop at this.
This was the fundamental antithesis of Mobile Homestead. On the one hand, things that were personal, dark, private, obsessional. On the other hand, Mike wanted to produce the possibility of his own home, this place that stood for himself, in the end finally being able to do some objective public good.
Of course, Kelly himself wrote that public art is often a pleasure forced upon a public that takes no pleasure in it.
The very fabric of Mobile Homestead, the very kind of the base on which it stands, is the idea that public art may in the end be based on lies and deception. It may be based on wishful thinking at the very least.
And maybe the public part of ourselves, the part we share with the world, also stands on a base of lies and deception and wishful thinking. That's what Freud said, more or less. Mobile Homestead started out as an ambitious piece of false biography, but it strikes me as Kelly's most honest work. Mobile Homestead is Mike, in its earnest but kind of silly ideas about community, in its big wink at public art, in the way it makes kitsch out of trauma, and the way it is genuinely kind of disturbing. All that is Mike, and in spite of everything he was going through, Kelly felt that Mobile Homestead deserved the chance to live.
I wanna go home. I wanna go home.
For Studio 360, I'm Julia Lowry Henderson.
Oh Lord, I wanna go home.
You can see pictures of Mike Kelly's mobile homestead at studio360.org. Coming up, the former First Lady of France is delighted to put politics aside and return to music.
I'm not political at all, no. I don't think I'd be good in political, you know, it's a job. Decisions, responsibilities, I don't have it.
That's Carla Bruni right here in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion, presenting the new 2014 Scion TC. With modified steering and suspension to improve driving precision and a new look, The Scion TC is designed to go the distance. Learn more at scion.com.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson.
Je ne suis pas in da. Je ne suis pas
a decade ago, the former supermodel Carla Bruni released an album, her first, surprising lots of people who'd been more than a little skeptical of her as a musician. That album went on to sell 2 million records. And then she surprised the world again 5 years ago when she married the French president, Nicolas Sarkozy. That aspect of her life, temporarily at least behind her, Carla Bruni is still making music. She just put out her fourth very lovely record called Little French Songs, and she joins me now here in the studio. Carla Bruni, welcome to Studio 360.
Hello, thank you.
So this is your first album since your husband left the presidency.
Yeah, right, exactly.
Did you consciously put your musical career on hold while he was president?
Not really on hold. It was just, yeah, it was on hold. But, there was so much work to do. And also there was so much, charity work to do. That was great.
Being first lady.
Yeah, but it was great because then you can help people. A different position. So, and also it was very fast because it was only 5 years,
yeah.
4 years.
Yeah.
At our age, for us, you.
Yes, as we know. And on this album, naturally, given that your husband has been president, he's still a political figure, you were first lady, people say, looking for political meaning and import and connections in the songs. Were there any consciously?
No, I don't think so.
Yeah? It seems, though, that you don't consider yourself a particularly political person.
Oh, I'm not political at all.
Yeah.
No. Those years were great because you can do all this charity work and help the other people. That I really like.
Right.
But I don't think I'd be good in political. It's a job.
Yeah, but it's a performative job
dealing
with the public, and that's what you've done for a long time.
I can deal with the image, related to politics, but certainly not with the real
job. Yeah, the backroom fighting
and
all that. Yeah.
And also decisions, responsibilities. I don't have any gift for that. No skill.
Then you're well out of it. The song you're going to start us off with, Shay
Keith et Anita.
Yeah. Tell us a little bit about what it is.
And
I know who Keith and Anita
Keith
are.
Keith and Anita is actually, of course, I'm not really talking about them.
Not Keith Richards and Anita Pallenberg?
Yeah, exactly. But I'm not really talking precisely or personally about Keith Richards and Anita Pallenberg. I was talking about this house in the south of France called Nelcote, where it was recorded a record and was shot a reportage by this French photographer called Dominique Tarlet.
This is where Exile on Main Street
was
shot?
The album was Exile on Main Street.
Yeah.
And the reportage seems to be absolutely incredible. There was many people, not only the Stones, just people hanging out there. And, that time of the history, after the 60s, beginning of the 70s, everything seems to be so free and so relaxed and so cool.
Yes.
And nothing ever is like this anymore, right? So I was born.
Well, probably it wasn't that way then either, only in retrospect.
I'm sure. It's more of a song like, no matter where you are, you can be in the street, you can be in the metro, you can be stuck somewhere, you can be doing a job that you don't like so much, but you can dream on. It's a song about a dreamer, really, which, of course, I am. I'm a complete daydreamer. And so instead of being stuck somewhere where you don't like it, you can just go to Keith and Anita. That's what the song says.
Well, let's hear a live performance from Carla Bruni and her guitarist, co-vocalist, Taufik Farah.
Yes, very good.
And this is Shay Keith and Anita off her new album, Little French Songs.
Dans les bagnoles, au Batignolles, à Istanbul, avenue du Roule, sur un atoll, ou dans la foule, on est là où l'on peut. À Notre-Dame, au bord du drame, à Macao, à Birmingham, dans un bistrot ou sous un tram, on est là où l'on peut. Moi je ne suis pas là, non, je suis chez Keith et Anita. C'est le petit matin, mais on n'est pas couché, ma foi. Quelqu'un se roule la joint, oh non merci, je ne fume pas. Quelqu'un joue du Chopin. On est chez Keith et Anita. Quelqu'un joue du Chopin.
retourner chez Keith et Anita. Dans une poubelle, le nez au ciel, dans un hôtel, au Sofitel, à Singapour, à Bruxelles, dans un tunnel, mis sous tutelle, au petit jour, au grand carrefour, on est là où l'on peut. Au fond du trou, à l'aube blême, au rendez-vous, à la traîne, à Malibu, à Valenciennes, à Katmandou, à Saint-Étienne, dans les verrous, ou à la Madeleine, on est là où l'on peut. Mais moi je ne suis pas là, non, 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 je suis chez Keith et Anita, c'est la fin de l'été. Mais il fait encore doux, ma foi. Quelqu'un boit du rosé et quelqu'un joue de l'harmonica qui fait bon d'exister. Ici chez Keith et Anita, qui fait bon d'exister. Ici chez Keith et Anita. Politique en place publique à l'aventure dans l'Antarctique, à l'âge tendre, canonique au bord du Gange, à Dubrovnik sous les louanges, couvert de fange, on est là où l'on peut. Au fond du trou, à l'aube blême, au rendez-vous, à la traîne, à Malibu, à Valenciennes, à Katmandou, à Saint-Étienne, sous les verrous, ou à la Madeleine, on est là où l'on peut. Moi je ne suis pas là, non, 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 je suis chez Keith et Anita. Ici tout est tranquille. Il n'y a pas l'ombre d'un tracas, Marianne sans la vanille, toute de velours et de soie, comme la vie scintille. Ici chez Keith et Anita, comme la vie scintille. Ici chez Keith et Anita. C'était l'été 70, je ne savais rien de tout ça, et pourtant j'arrivais chez Keith. C'était l'été 70, je ne savais rien de tout ça, et pourtant j'arrivais chez Keith.
I'm Kurt Anderson, and that was Carla Bruni performing her song Chez Keith and Anita off her new album Little French Songs. Naturally, because you're who you are, you've lived in France for most of your life, people think, oh, she's a chanson. This is what she is. That's the tradition she's in. Do you think of yourself being in that musical tradition?
Yeah. Writing in French and then writing the music for French lyrics puts you in a chanson, you know, because, of course, you know, it's not very modern, you know. My music is very sort of like folk music, you know, simple. And, yeah, I guess, you know, when you write in French, that what makes it chanson, you know, chanson française, because French is not such an easy language to write. And especially,
why is that?
Well, it's very rich to write, but it's not a very easy language to sing.
Uh-huh.
Because it's English has a lot of rhythm, Italian has a lot of vocality, you
uh-huh.
know, it has, you know, Italian, you seem like you're singing when you're reading the menu, and and English has a lot of, you know, really, it has beat and rhythm, and it carries you with his beat. What French is not very musical. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's not always on the same tune. Bah, 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 bah.
Well, in that song in particular that you just sang,
yeah.
you stick yeah. a lot of words.
I stick a lot of words, yeah. Because the good point with French is that there is very rich to describe. You know, it has a lot of description, yeah.
In the title song off this record, Little French Song, singular, you mentioned some of the great famous French singers like
yeah.
Serge Gainsbourg and Edith Piaf and
yeah.
Jacques Brel.
Aznavour, Reggiani, Johnny Holiday.
Those are obviously all big figures that everybody knows, but it doesn't sound like those are specifically your inspirations or models.
Not really. They're like more – they're mixed. Some of them are my inspiration and the other are just part of our, you know, French cultural – you know,
patrimony.
Yeah, patrimoine.
Yeah. See, we can speak in two languages.
In Britain, yeah.
May we hear?
Very good accent, Kurt.
May we hear a little? Oh, I can fake the accent. I just can't actually understand the language. May we hear a little French song?
Yes, I just go and play it now.
Thank you.
Un, deux, trois. Quand tout va mal, when life goes wrong, try for a little French song. French song armé, puis démodé, mais si douce affreux donné.
une chambre d'or à l'envie, nostalgique à l'infini. Et quand on ne sait plus où to belong, try for a little French song. French song will take you to Paris, to Pigalle, Saint-Louis. French song are dancing sous la pluie de Bastille aux Tuileries. Because we have de quoi frimer, we have Brassens, Braden, Ferré, we have Boris, Vian, Barbara, Gainsbourg, Trenet, Prévert, Cosma. Because we have de quoi choisir, we have Aznavour, Jenny, Beko, Nougaro, Moustaki, Edith, Piaf, Clo, and Jenny. Oh oui, 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 bien sûr, ce n'est pas Duke Ellington, ce n'est pas Elvis ni Jackson. Ce n'est pas Fitzgerald ou Armstrong, c'est just a little French song. Mais quand le chagrin reste tout long, moi je chante une little French song. Because we have de quoi frimer, we have Brassens, Brel and Ferré, we have Boris, Vian, Barbara, Gainsbourg, Trenet and Jean Ferrat. Because we have de quoi choisir, we have Aznavour, Jenny, Beko, Nougaro, Moustaki, Edith, Piaf, Clo, Clo and Jenny. Oh oui, 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 et qu'on soit de Londres ou de Hong Kong, qu'on soit trois feuilles choubon, qu'on soit Djellaba ou Sarong, try for a little French song, ouais. Et quand les méchants sonnent à leur gong, moi je chante une little French song.
That was Carla Bruni singing, finger snapping, and whistling a little French song off her new album of the same name, accompanied on guitar in that song by Taoufik Farah. That was lovely. And the whistling.
You like the whistling?
Well, yeah, and I heard it on the recording, but I didn't expect you to suddenly whistle here in the studio.
I'm the main orchestra.
Yeah, exactly.
With the hand and the whistle. I like to whistle. It's not so easy because it's not so easy to be tuned, you know, when you whistle. But here, oh, it's a very good sound.
Really?
Yeah.
Most of the songs, like that one, are in French with a little bit of English thrown in.
Yeah,
little
that's
French
a Fringlish.
But you've also got this song on the album called Douce France.
Dolce France.
Dolce France, which is an Italian version of the French song.
Yeah.
By the famous French singer Charles Trenet. Do you feel more Italian or French?
I feel more Italian. I've been recently French. You know, I got French when I was married.
Although you lived in France for many years.
I lived in France, but, you know, Europe is so much like, you know, Europe that I never thought, you know, I never thought of becoming French.
Right. I'm talking about you grew up in the EU generation.
Yeah, right. So we all had the same passport, you know.
Right.
And I became French when I got married because of my husband's position. And
that makes sense.
I would have probably remained Italian, which is, you know, we're cousin, French and Italian.
Yeah.
Yeah. Jean Cocteau used to say French people are Italian people in a bad mood.
That's funny.
Yeah.
That seems true.
Kind of true.
Who operate their country a little better, however.
Yeah.
Are you going on tour and performing?
Yes,
as you,
I'll be going on tour in France, then in Europe, and even coming to United States.
Yeah.
I can't believe I can do that. Such a lucky, and I'm looking forward, really, to come and play and to be able to tour again. That's the nicest part, really.
It has been a pleasure meeting you and talking to you. Thank you so
That's
very,
for
very
me
much.
Too, Kurt. Very much. Thank you for inviting me. And thanks for letting us play. It's wonderful.
Thank you. Carla Bruni's new album is called Little French Songs, and it is out right now. You can hear another song Carla Bruni recorded for us at studio360.org. My conversation with her originally aired on WNYC's Soundcheck. And that's it for this hour of Studio 360. Thank you very much for listening. Studio 360 is a co-production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Ital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Michelle Siegel,
Jenny Lawton,
John Delore,
Sean Ramosferam,
Alana Harper,
Anne Hepperman,
Eric Malinsky,
Chloe Plant,
Wayne Schulmeister,
Rachel Lewis Krisky,
Ellen Mayer,
Mark Sheely.
Thanks this week to WNYC's Katie Bishop and, as always, Chris Bannon. Our theme music is by David Van Tiegum. And don't forget to check out our mixtape, 10 great songs submitted to our high school band contest. Let us know what you think. Leave a comment on the site or on Twitter, at Studio 360 Show. You can also find me on Twitter. I'm at KB Anderson. That's Anderson, S-E-N.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion, presenting the new 2014 Scion TC. With modified steering and suspension to improve driving precision and a new look, the Scion TC is designed to go the distance. Learn more at scion.com. And by an award from the National Endowment for the Arts. Art works.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360, you want to know what a war zone is really like? Just look on Vine, where U.S. troops are making six-second movies about their lives.
Being deployed has its downtime.
You guys want to see what Afghanistan looks like?
We got dirt.
We got piles of dirt. What's that over there? F-ing dirt.
Soldier Vines. Next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. From my war, the